Accession number 30389, reel 4.
When we moved in and got settled in and they were doted over Susan, she said, did we play bridge? And I said, funny, no, we don't really, but we have been learning with the people we were living with. And they said, what? And I said, well, they were teaching us auction bridge. Ah, no good, she said, contract bridge. We teach you how to play contract bridge. So we used to get together nearly every evening with them after Susan had gone to bed and play contract bridge. They taught us and we got quite good, I think. And so we had quite an enjoyable time with them, but they'd never had children, as I say, and I'd got Susan, who was then probably 3 or 4 months old. And I used to do what I'd always done with babies when I was nursing, get her up in the morning, get her bath, put her in the pram, put her outside. Didn't matter what the weather was, outside. And so I used to do this. And dead on 5 o'clock, I'd bring her in, bath her, feed her, and by 6 she was in bed. Total routine. So I had the evenings when he came in, no babies and things like that. And she used to say to me, you are cruel, bringing that baby in out of that sunshine and putting her to bed. And I used to say, I'm sorry, but she's my baby and I will bring her up in my way. And one night she was so incensed when I said this to her, she said, I'm going to wait for the captain. And off she stormed to the drive to wait for him coming home over this five-barred gate. She was leaning there waiting for him to come in, and as soon as he came, she said, I need a word with you, that cruel wife of yours. Well, he knew I'd been a nurse, and he knew. But he said, I'm sorry, Mrs. Mendel, but that's I can't interfere with her at all. She thought I was wicked. She liked playing bridge, though, as well. And on a Friday, and we were ever so hard up. I mean, we really didn't have any money. I think he would know what his pay was in those days, something like 11 shillings a day. And me not working at all, earning at all, and there were no family allowances. So we were really, and the time we'd paid for our rooms and things, it was horrendous.
How were you spending your time during the day?
Helping in the house, keeping our two rooms clean, and taking Susan for long walks. You know, we had a beautiful pram for her, and I used to take for long walks. And really devoting my life to Susan and helping in the house, and they had this maid, and she used to do all the cooking. And that was a bit about it. Lazing my time, really. I used to go to the camp, obviously, when when there was anything happening. They used to have concert parties, and I used to go up there and got to know the other officers and their wives. And then there was a rookery at this farm, and Mr. Mennell used to shoot the rooks. And Nellie, the maid, used to make rook pie. I'd never had that before, and it was absolutely delicious. And so when they made rook pie, we were invited to a meal. And there was an outbuilding of this farm where Nellie used to do all the cooking and the baking. And there were no fridges, remember, you know. So it was cold out there, and she used to bake for a week. Pies of every kind, you know, fruit pies, meat pies, whatever there was available. And because he was in the farming community, they never were short of anything. They swapped, you see, so there was never a shortage of anything. And we were part of this, you see, and we had cream and fresh milk and beautiful food and things like that. And Susan really did thrive, you know, she was an absolutely gorgeous baby. And then on a Friday, they had a big old car. I can't remember what kind of a car it was, but it was huge. And they used to drive into York to buy fish. And they always bought halibut. And they used to come home with this halibut and say, you are to join us for lunch. And we used to have halibut and chips with the Mendels in their kitchen. And then a fruit pie of some kind. And that was their treat to us, and we hadn't had to pay. But I remember the first time we had this lunch, I thought I was being polite when I said at the end of the meal, gosh, I'm so full, that was lovely. She said, don't you dare, she said to me. We don't gloat about food. Mind you, she'd got all her floors in the upstairs rooms had all been taken up and they were packed with tin stuff. She had been collecting through the wall, but they were a dear couple and so was Nellie. And Nellie lived in, and she'd been with them since she left school at 14, and at the time that we were there she was about 40. And she told me once she cut 10 shillings a week, plus her keep. After all those years, she'd never had a rise. But I think probably they clothed her as well, you know, looking back. I just thought she was very badly treated when we were there. And so we stayed with them, and then Dennis was posted to Berwick-on-Tweed from there. And by this time, you see, it's 1943, so Susan's two. Whenever he was posted, I used to go back to Grimsby to my parents. And then when he found me somewhere to live, then I used to go off with Susan. And so we went to Berwick-on-Tweed, and first of all, we had rooms with a Mrs. Marshall, whose son was in the Air Force. She'd given us rooms and lived with her, and that was quite fun because she taught me a lot of cooking. And so Dennis came home one day. He was a captain then, and several of the other officers that hadn't got their wives with them used to come. And I was a very basic cook, but Donald, one of the officers, was the messing officer, so he used to come with his little sandbag with a bit of food of some sort in it. And I used to concoct a meal, and I mean, they were really, really ever such happy times. And Dennis came in from... No, Donald, one day after... And we used to play bridge, you see, afterwards. And Donald said to me, this messing offer, he said, "Joan, why don't you ask the CO for an evening?" And I said, "Donald, you're joking, aren't you?" He said, "No, I'm not." He was a Lieutenant Colonel Mulligan. And his wife was doing Red Cross work in London, driving ambulances and things like that. He said, "He's a very lonely man, you know." I said, "Oh, I couldn't, you know, have someone like that. I mean, we just have a laugh and we have fun." And he said, "Joan, you'd be surprised." He said, "He plays bridge, so let me bring him down one night for a game." And I was pretty confident by this time, you know, with my worldly experience, if you like, and I thought, yeah, I'm sure I can cope. But I was butterflies inside this commandant, you know, command coming. And Dennis didn't like it because it looked like currying favour. Can you understand what I'm trying? Those were the times that it looked awful. And so he said, "It's up to you." And so anyway, he came. And we drank pink gin. And we drew for partners for bridge. And I drew him, obviously. And he and I won. And we'd had just a snack, a nibble, you know, with the drink. And then when he and Donald went off, he thanked me very much for the evening. He was a charming man. And he thanked me very much for the evening. And apparently on the way back, he said to Donald, "I like that Mrs. Parkin. She's a capable lass too." Because I was only a lass, really. And so then some weeks after that, Donald asked me if I would invite him to a meal. And I said, "You're pushing it, really." And he said, "No, he so enjoyed the evening, and I'll bring the food." So again, he brought his little sandbag. And Mrs. Marshall showed me how to make some special soup, and I made that. I can't remember now what we had. But we invited him for a meal, and then played bridge afterwards. And he and I won again. It's just pure luck. It's got nothing to do with your skill. And we won again. And he drank Dennis's whiskey. He bought him a half a bottle of whiskey because he knew he drank whiskey, and he drank that. But that was, it was just, it made me ever so proud that he wanted to come, you know, to our place. Anyway, that was it. And then soon after that, we used to go up to the officers' mess for evenings, you know, like I said, concerts and dinners and things like that. And I remember one incident. We'd been up to the mess, not for food, but for drinks. And we were coming back to where we were living, and there was a cenotaph. And before the cenotaph, there was a fish and chip shop. Dennis was in uniform, and I was coming back, and this fish and chips really did smell good. And I said to him, "Shall we have some fish and chips?" And he said, "Can't do that." So I said, "Well, we can take them home." Oh, all right, then, he said, because he was a stickler for... So I went into this fish shop and got some fish and chips wrapped in newspaper, of course. And so as we were walking towards the cenotaph, I'd made a little hole, and I took a chip out. Said to him, do you want a chip? And he said, don't you dare. And I was so angry, I let fly with this fish and chips at the cenotaph. That's another little thing. It was terrible. But, I mean, I know, you know, when you look back on these incidents, I know he had a part to play. I mean, if any of the soldiers had seen an officer and his wife eating fish and chips, but at the time I didn't think that, because we were just very ordinary people, you know, living just different lives. He never forgave me for that, I don't think, because it was the war memorial as well. So we had our moments. But then he was posted down to... another incident when we were at Berwick-on-Tweed. After we left Mrs. Marshall, we found a furnished house just around the corner in Levain Terrace. And this was a really big stone house. Lovely. And I think Susan was about 2 years old, or perhaps less than that. And it was a really big house, and at the back of the house, through the kitchen, was a scullery. And it had a deep basin for you to do your washing. Didn't have a washing machine or anything like that. It's a big thing. And so I used to go a couple of times a week to do the washing in this great big sink. And one day when I turned the tap on, the water wasn't running away, so I put my finger in the plug and did that, and it was a dead mouse. And I screamed and screamed and screamed until the neighbours came. That's how I got to know the neighbours. They came round. I was absolutely terrified of this dead mouse. That was just another thing. Oh, it was hard. Because I touched it, you know. Anyhow, we had quite a nice time up there. And then when Dennis came home one day and said he'd been posted to this holding battalion in Norfolk, he said, it'll be only a question of time before I go overseas, so I think, you know, you better go back to Grimsby and get sorted. And I said, all right. And so I wrote to my mother, because we didn't have phones or anything like that, and I wrote to my mother and said that Dennis would shortly be going overseas, and could I go home with Susan to live? And she wrote back and said, by all means, come back to Grimsby. I'll find some rooms for you somewhere. I couldn't believe it, because my dad was away from home. So I just said, all right, and... So I went back to Grimsby with Susan, and on the train I met a girl I was at school with, and so we sat together and chatted, and I told her, you know, the news, and she said, and I said, I've got to my mother's got me some rooms somewhere, and she said, my sister's gone off to stay with her husband, you know, wherever he's posted. She wants to let her house furnished for 25 shillings a week. Would you be interested? And I said, oh yes, please. And so that was from the train journey. I met this girl and I got this furnished house, 3-bedroom furnished house for 25 shillings a week. That was wonderful. And so I went, of course, to my mother's when I arrived and said I'd got this house in Knight Street, and I moved into this house with Susan. My mother was odd. She and I really didn't get on awfully well, I have to say, because my father... I doted on my father, and he was probably, I don't know, he used to go on benders, my dad. He was, when he was at this ice factory, payday was Friday, and my mother would clock watch, because he used to come home for lunch, and he used to get home about 12:15, and my mother used to clock watch. I remember this clearly, and if it got just past 12:15, she'd say, oh no, not again. And he'd gone straight to some club, working man's club, and blew the wages in. And so there was no money for my mother for housekeeping or anything. Didn't happen often, but when it did, it was disastrous. It really was awful. And then, of course, they didn't speak. There'd be days on end when they never spoke, and we used to sit at the table there waiting for it to... And my mother used to put my father's plate on in front of him. And he used to try to talk to her, and she wouldn't respond, and she'd get up and walk away. And I know the movement. He used to do that. with his plate, just push it away with like that, and wouldn't eat it. Remember those sort of things. And then if he was working on a late shift, which he sometimes did, she used to save a meal for him on the top of a pan of boiling water. And when he had it, when he came in, it was put before him. And my sister and I used to sit one either side of him, because we'd had our dinner and we'd had our tea and this was my dad's dinner. And we used to sit one either side of him, and he used to give us bits like this. And when he got towards the end of his meal, and this is vivid as well, he used to make a mountain or a pyramid in the middle of his plate with his vegetables and his potatoes. And he used to feed us this pyramid of vegetables. Lovely man. So that was that. So anyway, I went home and I said to my mother that I'd met this girl on the train and I was moving to this furnished house. And I did. And I was thrilled because I was independent. I felt that I was independent. And I think I might have taught you about living there. That was my first experience of bombs, really, apart from the bombing on York. And then they started bombing Grimsby while I was there, and they dropped, for the first time, something that was called butterfly bombs on Grimsby. And they were anti-personnel things. So people the next morning went and found these. You know, they used to go looking for shrapnel and they found these and they picked them up and then they exploded and they were killed instantly. And I had several, I won't say friends, but people I knew that were killed this way, and it was very sad. And then when the sirens first started to go and there was only Susan and I there, I didn't used to take any notice and used to carry on until they started dropping bombs. And I thought, this is silly, we've got to get some shelter. And there was an Anderson shelter in the garden covered with air, sunk down. And we used to have, we had bought something called a siren suit, which was an all-in-one garment, you know, like a boiler suit, really. Because that was the quickest thing to get into, out of bed and into your siren suit. And you had your little case ready with your insurance policies and any papers you wanted to keep, your little bits of jewellery, if any. So you used to put on your trouser suit, zoot suit, get the baby, and wrap her in a big blanket, and go to the shelter. And I did this. I think it was almost the first time I'd done it, and that I could hear bombs dropping, but I had no idea how serious it was. And I got to the back door of the house with Susan, you know, and I'd put this case down to open the door, to unlock the door and turn the handle, and I just got my hand on the handle, and there was a bomb dropped about a couple of hundred yards away. So the blast blew open the back door and threw me and Susan all the way across the kitchen against some cupboards. I was terrified, absolutely terrified, because it was just the blast. You know, I didn't know then what it was, but absolutely terrified. And Susan, of course, started to cry, and I was trying to pacify her and just equally terrified. And then the lady that lived next door, who I only knew, you know, briefly to nod to, she called to me and she said, would you like us to come in? Would you like to come into our shelter? Or words to that effect. And so she sort of rescued me from that dilemma, and we went into this air raid shelter and sat there trembling from head to foot while these bombs started dropping around. And so I made a friend of hers, and then we said we would, because she had children, and we said we'd go together in either one, so that we went alone. And some weeks after this, Dennis came home on embarkation leave. And as soon as the siren went, I was out of bed, you see, to get my bits. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going down in a shelter. He said, don't be silly. And he'd just come, you know, from Norfolk somewhere. Anyway, I said, well, we've got to go. So we got up and we went down, and Susan and I scuttled down the shelter. And he stood outside, you know, he wasn't going to go down into an air raid shelter till the first bomb fell. He was down there quicker than anything, you know. So we had a few experiences like that. And then my father, although he only used to come home every 6 weeks, he was home on weekend when we had one of these bomb things. And it was only so and I, Dennis had gone by then, and he came to see if we were all right. And there were unexploded bombs along the road we lived in. And my dad had just sidestepped them, I suppose, I don't really know. So we were lucky in as much as something could have happened, and it never did. But there were huge unexploded bombs and these personnel bombs. So there was, and then one night, I had some friends on leave from the ATS, who were single still, of course, and they'd been called up. And two of them were coming home on leave for the first time, and they asked me if I could get a babysitter and we could have an evening out. And so we did, and we went to a dance and had a drink, and then the siren went. So I called a taxi and said, get me home as quickly as possible. It was about a 15-minute run in the taxi. And when I suppose we got nearly home, my neighbour had got Susan, so, you know, I hadn't left her anything.
I think you ought to have a little break now.
We were about halfway home and the siren went and there was a dogfight going on up above, and this wretched taxi driver stopped. He said, I can't miss this. I said, you better get me home or you'll miss a lot more. And he was ever so reluctant because he wanted to watch what was going on, and I got home. Susan was down with my neighbour in the shelter, but little things like that are, you can't imagine them happening now, except perhaps in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't know how they cope. It's very hard. It was hard then, you know, and I remember when Dennis went off, you know, after this embarkation leave, and I think this is the worst part of it, you know, for women. I don't know again about women today, because I don't know whether they have the same feelings anymore towards their men. I don't know. Perhaps that's scepticism. But you're standing on the station waiting for the train to pull out, and you're in knots, because you don't know if you're ever going to see them again, for one thing. That was awful. That was really dreadful. But you survive. See, if you're lucky, you survive. And then I went back with my mother, and pretty upset. And I was still living in this house in Knight Street, and so I went back there eventually. And I was alone for, I can't remember how long, quite a long time. And I used to work like mad, like housework, you know. I used to scrub floors and scrub paintwork and all that sort of thing to try to take your mind off what was going on. And I used to write every day, sometimes twice a day, and say what we'd been doing. And they were all sent to an army base post office somewhere. And I mean, he would go weeks and weeks and weeks and not have any post, and then get a pile, you know. That he, and it was the same with me, and we were in the sitting room every morning watching for the postman to come to see if there was anything. And then eventually, do you want to stop? Because I go on unmercifully. Quell my conscience by saying at the end of it all, I was here when he came back, waiting for him. A lot of them weren't. They'd gone off with Yanks, and I was still there. So although I'd played the field a bit, I was still there. And I was going to say we lived happily ever after, more or less we did. But he was...
Darling, are you ready?
Yes, darling, what have you done? Yes, it was talking about waiting for letters to arrive. And I kept every one of mine, as I told you. Of course, Dennis didn't, but then he was in the fighting, and I suppose everything went off. From time to time, I do read them, and then I get an idea of what I've said to him. I expect there are millions of people that have got boxes of letters like this. But they were ever so important to me. And I used to sit and read them to Susan. I used to say, there's a letter from your daddy, and I will read it to you. And I used to read all this, and she used just to look up and listen to this. I don't suppose she understood a word of it, really. But he was away for about 2 years, and then in and out of hospital for another two, so she really didn't know him very well. But on the day he came back from hospital in India after the war. I used to say to her, "Your daddy's coming home, your daddy's coming home." And we're going to the station to meet him. And on the day he arrived home on his birthday, and we went to the station and sat there, and there was a typical railway waiting room with a tiny little few embers in the fireplace. And there was an Air Force officer sitting there, and we sat beside him. And Susan said to him, "We have come to wait for my daddy." And he said, "That's fun." And she said, "Yes, and what do you think? He's got a medal." So he said, "Oh, has he? You must be very proud." And I'm sitting there just listening. And he said, "Shall I tell you something?" And she said, "Yes, please." He said, "I am waiting for my wife, and we are going to have a celebration because I have got a medal too." And he'd got the DSC or something like that. And so, of course, we started to talk. It was wonderful. And when the train eventually pulled in, he said to her, "I hope you soon find your daddy." And we went off down the platform, and he was right at the end of the train. We saw him get off, and he got his arm in plaster, of course, and the sling and everything on. And I said, "There's your daddy." And we started to run along the platform. And she didn't know who he was. You know, this is some of the sadness of war. And she didn't. She just stood there looking at him. And I had said to her, "It's his birthday today. So when you see him, you have to say, 'Happy birthday, Daddy.'" So when she pulled herself together, she said, "Happy birthday, Daddy. What have you brought me?" And he had brought her presents, you know, and things like that from abroad. But then, of course, we went... I've jumped all this again, because when my father died while I was in this house in Knight Street, and he was only 52, so it was very traumatic and very sad. And my mother asked me if I would go home to live, to help financially. So I gave up the house in Knight Street very reluctantly and went home to live. And there had been this tension between us all our lives. It wasn't anything new, and I knew it wouldn't be easy, and I'd got Susan with all her clot and what have you, but we moved in with my mother anyway. And life was very, very difficult, and after a few weeks or months, I said to her, "How about me getting a job? Would you be prepared to look after Susan," who was then 3, something like that, "and I will get myself a job." And she said, "I think that would be a good idea." And so I went to the Labour Exchange and said I was a trained nurse, and they were looking for a nurse at this nursing home in Cleethorpes that was run entirely by nuns. And so I had this card from them, and I set off for this place, St Hugh's Nursing Home, and I knocked on the door, and a little fat nun came, and I said, "I've been sent from the Labour Exchange." And she said, "Are you a nurse?" And I said, "Yes." And she went, "Thank you, God." It was just unbelievable. And I started almost immediately. But they were all nuns, you see, and they needed help. And so I started at St Hugh's Nursing Home, and there were about 12 nuns, something like that. And this was a new experience for me, because I didn't know anything about nuns or anything. But they were really super. I mean, they were all trained nurses, and so I worked with them. And when I had the telegram, the first telegram to say that Dennis had been wounded, I was absolutely heartbroken, and I said to my mother, "I can't go to work." I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I was in a state. And so my mother went out, because we didn't have a telephone, and she went out to the phone box and said, told the nuns what had happened. And within an hour, two of the nuns were at my front door, and they came in and they said, "We have come to take you on duty." And I said, "Oh, I can't. I've had this telegram." They said, "You are to get into uniform and you are to come with us." And I thought at the time it was ever so hard. And I got into uniform and I went off with them, and I went on duty, and I was crying. I'm very tearful and upset. And they all got together over a cup of tea or coffee or something like that, and they said, "Listen to us. He will come back to you. We'll see to that." This is something else again, you know, it takes in faith and that sort of thing, doesn't it?